context of all of the evidence. I mean, if you have somebody who's done 100 things wrong, but you also learn that there was an $800 payment or 22 phone calls, I don't think it matters that that's the only evidence of undisclosed phone calls. It has to be the impact of the 22 phone calls, the $800, and the $3,000, yeah. Right?
Right, yes. And getting back to one of Judge Wynn's concerns, characterizing the various witnesses that testified, not only did Judge Patterson at trial refer to Mr. Merrill as the key witness, the state said the same thing. And those are to be found at replacement brief ERs 27 and replacement brief ER 47, where the state characterized Merrill as one of the most important witnesses in this case.
Well, the state might have in its brief characterized Merrill like that, but as I read the state's closing argument in the trial, they tried to stay away from Merrill as much as possible.
Well, it can't be both ways, Judge, with respect. And to get back to the other issue of whether a qualitatively different type of suppressed Brady evidence makes a difference, I refer you to Bagley, which is clearly established federal law that applies to this case.
What, in that case, can I back up a little bit? Because why does Bagley apply to this case? Bagley came out after the Arizona Supreme Court issued its final decision in June of 1985. So why is it that Bagley would be clearly established law here?
Well, for three reasons. One, Hooper was not final until January 12, 1986, which was explicitly acknowledged by the district court in its order and conceded by the state in its brief. So,
well, I agree with that, and I'll ask the state the same question, but it seems to me that the concession by the state doesn't waive that issue for us. And I had always understood clearly established law had to be based upon the final decision from the Arizona Supreme Court on the question, not the finality. And that may have changed after the district court made that ruling that you're referencing back in 2008. So anyway, I mean, let's set Bagley aside. Go ahead with your argument, assuming Bagley does apply.
Okay, assuming Bagley does apply, the question before that court was a fairly de minimis, a couple of fairly de minimis payments to centrally important witnesses in that case, which was suppressed. And the Bagley court said the payment of money didn't say this. These are my words. The payment of money is different in kind because it gives the witness a direct personal stake in respondent's conviction. The typical incentives that a state is expected to give cooperating witnesses is immunity and leniency. And those were the things that Mr. Merrill enjoyed in spades. He was a central...
But wasn't Mr. Merrill, I mean, wasn't it brought out that this deal allowed Mr. Merrill to himself avoid the death penalty?
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
How does 22 phone calls and a few thousand dollars materially increase the likelihood that he's lying when the defense counsel pointed out repeatedly that he was cutting this sweetheart deal to himself avoid the death penalty?
Well, I think the law is fairly clear, at least from my reading of it, Your Honor, that the failure of even an enormous bundle of suppressed impeaching or exculpatory Brady evidence successfully gotten into the trial does not prove that additional evidence might not have made a difference, particularly in this case.
I think what you just said kind of brings me back to what the definition of materiality is in the standard, because the way you phrased it was couldn't have made a difference. And I think, you know, I might be more inclined to agree with you if that were the standard, but it seems to me that what we're looking at is this has to be material if if there's a reasonable likelihood that the false testimony could affect the jury, I think is the standard. But now that, but I guess that's a question for you is where, you know, what are you perceiving the standard to be? Because it can't be that there's just a possibility that it would affect it. Because
no, I respectfully disagree with your articulation of, okay, of materiality. The definition of materiality is whether in its absence, that is the evidence, the defendant received a fair trial, understood as a trial resulting in a verdict worthy of confidence. Now, instructive and possibly determinative is this evidence was discovered by Lukaszek's counsel, a co-defendant. When it came to the attention of Lukaszek's trial judge, he was quite outraged. Not only did he grant the motion for new trial based upon this suppressed evidence, but he instituted contempt proceedings against Brownlee, Jones, and Ryan. And after retrial, when the suppressed evidence was used in the second trial, Mrs. Lukaszek was acquitted. So that is some evidence that it was material. Juries, and ours was probably a closer case than hers. I don't know. I don't know how long her jury was out, but ours was a close, was a close, close case. So a little bit.
I do agree with you that I think monetary benefits, as a motivating factor for a particular witness is qualitatively different than other types of benefit. I'll give you that, but every case sort of rise or falls on its own set of facts. And here you've got, a few thousand dollars in change in financial benefit kind of weighed against immunity, which avoids for Mr. Merrill, the death penalty possibly, and then a whole host of other impeaching evidence against him as well, how do you weigh that in terms of the materiality standard, even assuming that Bagley applies? I think it's a much closer case. And that's why I started questioning you with regard to the findings by the Arizona Supreme Court, because there's a clear finding by the Arizona Supreme Court that the key witness really is not Mr. Merrill. He may be an important witness, but again, the Arizona Supreme Court characterized his testimony as merely corroborative. And I'm looking at the Arizona Supreme Court's discussion. It said the undisclosed information impeaching him and Dan Ryan had no effect on the key testimony of Marilyn Redmond. So in light, and it even talked about other cases where the witness is a key witness, maybe the only witness who can place the defendant at the scene or who can tie the defendant to the crime. I think that might be a different case. We can debate whether AEDPA reviews would cause you to lose that case as well, but that's a much closer case. And here we've got a case where, yes, you've got a qualitative undisclosed information that should have been presented to the jury. You weigh that against a lot of other impeaching evidence, but you also have to consider the context of the case where a witness was really characterized by Arizona Supreme Court as being merely corroborative. And I don't know how you get past that particular point.
Well, the Arizona Supreme Court's perception of the centrality of Ms. Redmond may or may not have been determinative for the jury. That's an impossible thing to know. But what we do know is that Ms. Redmond's description of the intruders was wildly variable over time. It began with three blacks and then two blacks and a white. The intruders were masked.
The jury heard all of that. So, am I understanding your argument correctly that in order for you to prevail in light of our discussion, we would have to find that the Arizona Supreme Court's factual determination of Marilyn Redmond as a key witness, the pivotal witness, we would have to find that that factual finding was unreasonable for you to prevail?
No, what I would say is their reliance on Marilyn Redmond's testimony is an outcome determinative test which violates the Brady materiality standard.
But counsel, it's not an outcome determinative test. I mean, the Arizona Supreme Court, in the same sentence that Judge Nguyen was reading, said, unlike State v. Lukaszek, Merrill's testimony in the instant case was merely corroborative and not pivotal, and the undisclosed information impeaching him had no effect on Redmond. And finally, unlike Lukaszczyk, there are a significant amount of other testimony linking your client to the crime.
Right.
So how can you win without, as Judge Nguyen posited, our finding that the Arizona Supreme Court's factual determination under AEDPA was quote unquote unreasonable?
Well, the determination that it was cumulative is factually unsupported by the record. First, because it's different in kind, and the case law distinguishes evidence that is different in kind from that which is cumulative.
That's Bagley that you're pointing to.
No, there are many subsequent cases, and the Arizona.
But what about preceding cases prior to that?
Oh, I think that NAPU versus Illinois, which is a 1959 case, we do not believe that the jury was appraised of other grounds for believing that the witness may have an interest in testifying against the petitioner, turned what was an otherwise tainted trial into a fair one. So it's making a distinction between the kind of evidence and whether it's qualitatively different and whether that qualitatively different evidence was suppressed.
So can you, I think Judge Bennett had asked this question before. You're talking about, you know, death penalty, potential death sentence, murder conviction being taken off the table for Merrill. Are any of those cases dealing with that situation? Because I think your argument would have more force if this were money, you know, in addition to, hey, immunity for some minor role in a separate offense. But when you're talking about a role in murder where at least two of the other conspirators received the death penalty and it was definitely on the table, your argument seems to have less force. So how do you address that?
Well, I would submit that Brady is Brady regardless of the seriousness of the offense, and it has to be
that's not my question. My question is, you're saying it's qualitatively different.
Yes.
It might be qualitatively different as to some minor immunity, but how is a few thousand dollars qualitatively different from having a potential death penalty and murder conviction taken off the table?
Well, as Bagley says, and as other cases have said, and I'm sorry I don't have the cites, juries look with heightened suspicion at witnesses who are paid for their testimony. It's a different and more tawdry incentive. It's purchased testimony, which if attempted by a defense lawyer in a criminal case.
Does any of that deal with a case where you have, there can't be that many cases out there where death penalty was also taken off the table to a potential witness and they're addressing money. And that's, I think that's the difference. Bagley wasn't that kind of a case.
Well, Lukaszczyk certainly was. It was the death case. That had gone to verdict.
But you're using that as an example for how.
Yes. In contradistinction to what the judge did in the Hooper case, the judge in the Lukaszczyk case granted the new trial, held prosecutor and investigator in contempt, and when the new evidence was presented to that second trial, she was acquitted. So, one can infer, I think, reasonably, that this was important. Juries look with great suspicion on paid witnesses and expect, as a matter of course.
Counsel, even on the legal theme that you're positing, wasn't Merrill, quote unquote, paid for his testimony because he was placed in a more relaxed prison cell because he was allowed to come back to Arizona by himself, even though he had a murder warrant out for him. He was allowed to taken out of jail to have sex with his wife. And all these things came out. Isn't that essentially being paid for his testimony?
No, I respectfully disagree. Those are benefits. Those are leniency and other benefits. But it's not the exchange of money, and the fact that it was suppressed throughout the trial gives you gives you a view of what Brownlee, Jones, and Ryan thought about its potential explosive character. Not only was there $3,000 paid to Mrs. Merrill and several hundred dollars paid so her car didn't go into repossession and 22 long distance calls, but the hotel rooms in which Mr. and Mrs. Merrill had sex was also picked up by the county.
So not to cut you off, but is this your, of the three Brady, do you agree that there's basically three Brady issues, the benefits to Merrill and then the photos and the police reports?
Yes, sir.
The Brady issues we're dealing with.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is the Merrill evidence the strongest of your three Brady issues?
I would say probably without diminishing the centrality of the evidence, which gets us into a discussion of the timeliness of disclosure for purposes of allowing the defense a fair opportunity to structure its case from the outset.
On the photos and the police report.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So to me, those all come down to one question, and maybe you can address this. Mm-hmm. What would they have done differently? What would the defense have done differently had they had that evidence earlier? Because it seems like everything ultimately was presented or could have been presented.
Well, I refer the court to Amato versus Gonzalez, which is a recent Ninth Circuit case, which asked the question, didn't the defense have a responsibility once it got an inkling of this suppressed evidence to make heroic investigative efforts such that it could deal with and counter the late disclosed and surprising evidence? And the court unequivocally said there is no duty on defense to do that because Brady puts an affirmative duty on the state to disclose. Now,
but respectfully, counsel,
I mean, sir,
they did get it during trial.
Yes.
And it's only even arguably a Brady violation if there was something about the late disclosure that prevented them from using it effectively, since they actually did get it. There's no case that I know of that says Brady absolutely requires pretrial disclosure, and certainly not when this was before the Arizona Supreme Court.
No, but the law is clear that the disclosure has to be made at a time when it can be of value.
Yes, but wasn't it a value here? I mean, they were able to use it, and that's why my question is, what would they have done different had they had it 2 months before trial or a month before trial?
Well, in Mr. Wood's motion for mistrial, he wrote quite clearly what he would have done had he had the
I read that as well.
Police reports, but it's difficult to know in retrospect because it requires us to speculate about things that didn't happen but could have happened.
Now you're on appeal saying that you were hurt by the late disclosure.
Yes.
So I think you've got to be able to answer the question of where's the lost value.
Okay.
Which goes to Judge Nelson's question of, okay, you got it late.
Right.
How did it change the picture? What would you have done differently? And there's got to be an answer for that, I think, as to the photographs and the police report for you to even begin to climb uphill on as to those two issues.
Well, there is an answer, and it's a good one. These are the things that would have changed. Jury voir dire, utilizing the fact of and the descriptions and photographs of three alternative suspects. Jury selection. Opening statement, cross-examination of the police, who said to a man, I believe, that the reason the three suspects weren't apprehended was because at the time of their apprehension, it was impossible for them to have committed the crime. All of those police officers would have been found to be not telling the truth. So although it's difficult to reconstruct...
I mean, the part of the problem, the first two examples you gave, the problem is if we adopted that, you'd basically be setting up a rule that Brady, requires pretrial disclosure, because anyone could say the same thing about.
Well,
is there something specific about voir dire or opening argument that would have changed? What would this have done? What, give me an example of a question that would have been asked on voir dire that wasn't asked because you didn't know about this.
Well, whatever the question would be, and I don't know, it would have put in the minds of the jurors the fact that there were three alternate suspects who arguably matched the suspects in custody, and the police.
I see. So you're not saying it would have actually changed the jury composition.
It may have.
Counsel, didn't the prosecutor show the photos to Mrs. Redmond, and didn't Mrs. Redmond testify these weren't the people who murdered her husband and her mother?
That's not in the record that I've read, Your Honor. I'm at 3 minutes.
You're at 3 minutes. Our questioning has taken you essentially exclusively in the Brady issue,
yes,
land, and you didn't get to address any of the other issues. Why don't you go ahead and use the remaining time addressing whatever other issues you want to, and I'll add 3 minutes on the clock for rebuttal.
Okay. First,
is there another issue that yes, is compelling in your view?
I think all three are, Your Honor.
Okay.
Tell me about the Eighth Amendment and the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
I there's some questions about whether the district court did everything properly, should have allowed you to amend to add the Eighth Amendment claim. But to me, the question comes down to, do you have an Eighth Amendment claim? Does your client have an Eighth Amendment claim? And does he have a due process claim? And I'd like to know what your strongest case on the merits for that.
Well, when the balance of aggravators and mitigators is materially altered, as it was in this case, by the vacature of the two weightiest aggravating circumstances used to impose death in this case, the question that I raised was, does that affect the validity of the death sentence? And on PCR, our fourth PCR, the PCR court simply engaged in what is called a prescribed automatic affirmance, finding that death was required regardless, which contravenes Johnson versus Mississippi. It contravenes Clemens versus Mississippi. And the 14th Amendment claim that I've tried to raise and hammer as well as I could was not responded to by the respondents and was not addressed by the district court. The argument is this. There is and it's during that era when aggravating circumstances were now being viewed as elements of greater offense. Therefore, Justice Scalia, when he was examining the case, said that aggravating circumstances as elements of the case, if they're improperly before the court or before the jury, there is a 14th Amendment due process violation unless one of the other aggravators provides all the facts and circumstances necessary to support that aggravator, which was improperly before the jury. What I've argued multiple times is that these two Illinois prior murder convictions and death sentences were the most powerful aggravating circumstances that there was. It's all that was talked about. And I've lost my train of thought.
This is on your due process claim, right?
Yes, thank you. If it can be found that no other aggravating circumstance supplies the facts and evidence necessary to support these two, then we have a fundamental 14th Amendment due process violation. My argument is this. Reweighing and harmless error analysis are Eighth Amendment violation techniques. They're Eighth Amendment violation techniques. They're designed to guarantee that the sentence does not offend the Eighth Amendment. A 14th Amendment due process violation, which we have here in spades, our position is, cannot be cured by harmless error or reweighing. And the reason that the Sanders case broke as it did was because Justice Scalia found that the evidence supporting the aggravator that was found to be flawed was clearly to be found in the other aggravators that, that stood. So what he did is he concluded there simply was no constitutional violation at all. He wasn't called upon.
Thank you, counsel. You're actually over time. So let's get to the state case. And then when you come back up, I'll put 3 minutes on the clock for your rebuttal.
Thank you very kindly.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jeff Sparks with the Arizona Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondents appellees. I'll start with the Brady claim as well. And the
actually,
benefits
if you don't to... mind, counsel, can I have you start with the Eighth Amendment claim?
Sure. So as far as the Eighth Amendment claim, what the state PCR court did here was a permissible reweighing of the remaining aggravating factors against any existing mitigating circumstances, as the Supreme Court had stated, is proper when a sentence was based on later invalidated aggravating factors in cases like Stringer v. Black, which is the clearly established federal law applicable to this claim.
So, counsel, is it your view that the reweighing that was required is satisfied by the PCR court saying there were no mitigating factors here? The Arizona Supreme Court found there were no mitigating factors here, so the absence of one aggravator makes no difference because there had to have been a death penalty anyway. Because it strikes me that's what they did. And is it your view that as a matter of law, that's enough?
It is, and that's correct as a matter of law because of the specific factual circumstances of this case. What happened here was not an automatic affirmance of the sentence, as Hoover was arguing. It was an application of Arizona's sentencing statute, which, at this time, the Supreme Court had addressed and said is not impermissibly mandatory. And or it looked at the remaining aggravating factors, which are strong. There was the especially heinous, cruel, or depraved, the pecuniary gain, which was proven by murder for hire in this case, and then reweighing those remaining circumstances against the existing mitigation in the record. And it just so happened that in this case, both the original sentencing court and the Arizona Supreme Court in its independent review on direct appeal had found that Hooper had failed to prove the existence of any mitigating circumstances. So applying those facts to Arizona law, the state PCR court permissibly concluded that a death sentence was still appropriate in conducting that reweighing.
Although it's a strange kind of procedural circumstance where the convictions hadn't yet been overturned.
It is a bit strange. I don't think that there is anything prohibiting that under Supreme Court case law, being that this claim, assuming amendment would have been allowed into the habeas petition, would have been proceeding under AEDPA. I'm not aware of any clearly established federal law that prohibits a state court from prospectively or proactively addressing a claim in that way.
Can I ask, so is your argument based on the fact that no mitigating evidence was presented? That's why this stands, meaning if there had been mitigating evidence presented, would there need to be a reweighing based on the two aggravating factors falling out later?
No, our position is not based on the fact that no mitigating circumstances were found originally or mitigation evidence presented. I think even if mitigation evidence had been presented, the state court still would have been required to go through a reweighing process like it did.
So, counsel, I'd also like to, and I'm, whenever you feel it appropriate, even though counsel didn't discuss this, I'd like to understand the state's position on trial counsel. Mr. Wood conducted very little, if any, investigation into mitigators. He explained why he did it. But how can it not be deficient performance? Put aside for the moment prejudice. But how could it not be deficient performance for Mr. Wood to have basically commissioned no investigation into possible mitigators?
Well, that goes back to Strickland itself, I think, which was also a case where defense counsel essentially did not, just elected not to investigate potential mitigation. And the court said in that case that that decision itself is reviewed for reasonableness under the circumstances with a heavy measure of deference to counsel's judgments. The Supreme Court has addressed that principle in later cases. For example, Pinholster, where it stated there is no constitutional duty to investigate, and it's not per se ineffectiveness not to investigate mitigation. That's something that, as any decision by counsel, is always reviewed for reasonableness under all of the circumstances.
So why was it reasonable here? I mean, there's no cost to having an investigator review something. The worst that can happen is you're not going to use it. So why was it reasonable here not to have an investigation?
It was reasonable here because, as Mr. Woods stated, he looked at the case. He was familiar with his client, the defendant. He, you know, he referenced when he was explaining his reasoning. His client was 35 years old at the time. He was a hired contract killer who flew to Arizona simply for the purpose of carrying out the crimes in this case. He viewed him as an intelligent person, and you know, we don't have much information about what he, if anything, he did look into. We do know that he had traveled to Chicago, where Hooper was from, several times in his investigation of the case in general. And looking at those circumstances, he concluded that any mitigation he would have been able to find and present wouldn't have made any difference with the sentencing judge. And he concluded that what he thought was a better tactic as far as improving the chances of obtaining a life sentence for his client was to essentially make an argument with the judge rather than present mitigation that he thought would be wholly ineffective.
But it was an argument that had no basis at all in Arizona law.
I don't think that's necessarily true, and that's because you know, under cases like Eddings, a sentencer has to be able to consider anything in the record as potentially mitigating. That could involve circumstances of the crime, anything that's presented in the guilt portion of the trial. So just because defense counsel does not present mitigation evidence at the sentencing proceeding, that doesn't preclude a sentencer from finding something mitigating in the record.
Okay, well, under I don't know if this is the same number now, but 13703G, where you talk about mitigating circumstances, is there anything in 13703G in which Mr. Woods's argument would fit, that basically the death penalty is immoral and judge, you're better than that?
Well, no, it certainly would not fit with any of the statutory mitigating circumstances. Now, whether that's something, you know, obviously the sentencing court didn't think that was an appropriate reason not to impose the death penalty, that he stated that in giving his reason for sentencing. But the fact that no mitigation evidence is presented, that doesn't mandate a death sentence, given that the court could consider other things to be mitigating potentially.
Here, the petitioner had asked to amend the petition to add the Eighth Amendment claim. What is your view? Because it seems like the district court didn't allow the amendment. Should the district court have technically allowed the amendment? I mean, ultimately came to the conclusion that it might have been futile, it sounds like, because there was no Eighth Amendment claim. But is there a procedural problem here where the district court didn't actually allow the amendment or provide better reasoning for why he didn't allow?
I don't think that there is, at least with this specific claim, because ultimately, whether the district court did what it did here, which is deny amendment under the grounds of futility after doing what's essentially a full merits review of the claim, or whether the court had allowed amendment and then reviewed the claim that way, I think we get to the same place either way. This is really a legal claim, a legal issue that didn't require factual development or anything of that nature. So the procedural way in which the court looked at it didn't preclude any factual development or that kind of a thing. So I think given that it was the same analysis that the court would have done had it allowed amendment, I don't think there's any problem with the court.
So, I mean, is that a suggestion that we should just accept that the district court, as a matter of practicality, did allow the amendment and then rejected it? Part of it is based on, and I don't think I got a clear answer to this in the briefing, is the threshold for amending a petition for habeas relief the same as it would be in, you know, the civil context, meaning if it's futile, then you just don't allow the amendment. I mean, is that how we should we look at it under that rubric, or should we say, no, there were some procedural hoops that the district court needed to jump through here and didn't properly do?
I'm not sure, you know, what the answer would be for every case or every type of issue. I think, though, that for this particular issue in this case, I don't see a problem with the district court denying amendment based on futility after looking at the claim and concluding that it has no chance of succeeding on the merits. Again, there may be situations where there are requests for evidentiary development or that kind of a thing, which may merit treating that amendment futility issue differently. But here, I don't think there's a strong reason to do that.
Counsel, I mean, the state has argued on the merits that amendment was futile because on the merits there's no claim. The petition argued the absolute reverse. You've both briefed it. The state, I take it, would not object to our reaching the merits of whether there actually is a substantive claim or not, right?
Not at all, no. No, we would not object to that. If I can address for a moment the issue of the related due process claim, if I understand that claim correctly, I believe it to be based on Sanders v. Brown. First, I would argue that Sanders is not clearly established federal law for this case, since it was decided after the state court did the reweighing. While it came out, while that decision was pending review by the Arizona Supreme Court denied review. It did not issue a substantive decision. And as this court has stated in cases like Barker v. Fleming, the clearly established federal law are the decisions that exist at the time of the last reasoned state court decision. That aside, even if Sanders were applicable here, it doesn't change the result. I understand Sanders is addressing the line of cases. You have Stringer v. Black, and then you have Zant v. Stevens, kind of similar but parallel lines of cases talking about when is there error based on a sentence being based on an invalid aggravating factor. And it had, the previous case law had differentiated between weighing states and non-weighing states. Sanders was the court's attempt to kind of simplify that analysis as far as, okay, when can we say an error in the sentencing has occurred? But nothing about that decision purports to overrule the well-established line of cases saying that when there is an error in sentencing based on an invalid aggravating factor, a court can essentially cure that error by conducting a reweighing of the aggravation and mitigation as occurred here, or a harmless error review. So even if Sanders were applicable, because that case discusses when an error in sentencing occurs, it isn't really germane to the issue here, which was a reweighing after the state court admitted or assumed that there would be an error if the Illinois convictions were vacated. So even if the due process claim is properly before the court, I don't think that it in any way changes the analysis or the reasonableness of the state PCR court's decision.
Counsel, remind me, what was the state's position in its brief as to whether the due process claim was exhausted or not?
Your Honor, I do not believe it's differentiated in between the Eighth Amendment and due process claim and essentially addressed it as a single issue. Which, for the reasons that, in discussing Sanders, I don't think that if there is a due process claim before the court, I don't think that it changes the analysis in any way.
Okay, but the state did not argue in its brief that the claim was unexhausted, the due process portion of the claim.
No, okay. I don't believe so.
Thank you.
I can, unless
you have time remaining, do you want to get to the Brady issues?
Yes, thank you. That's where I was going to move to now. First, about the standard. The Arizona Supreme Court correctly identified the applicable standard from Supreme Court case law, which here was United States v. Augers, which lists three different materiality standards depending on the circumstances. Here, where the type of information had been specifically requested by the defense and not disclosed, the standard, as correctly identified by the Arizona Supreme Court, was whether disclosure might have made a difference in the outcome. The court referenced that standard several times. So there's no question that the court identified and applied the correct standard from Supreme Court case law. And its decision under that was reasonable under the circumstances, as kind of the discussion with Mr. Phelan touched on. There were essentially two overlapping bases for the state court's decision. First, that the benefits, the financial benefits to Arnold Merrill were cumulative of a host of other impeaching evidence that was in front of the jury. And in addition to that, the fact that his testimony, while important to the case, was not pivotal. And in fact, the Arizona Supreme Court specifically referenced the Lucaszek case to differentiate the importance of Merrill's testimony in that case versus this case, in coming to its conclusion that there's no chance that the undisclosed impeachment would have made a difference here, given the role of his testimony in this case versus that other one.
Well, but help me out with that, because what about the argument that where the payments to Merrill were ultimately admitted in the Lutzwick case, there was an acquittal? How does that weigh in to, I mean, why isn't that some evidence that it might have made a difference in the outcome of the case?
It's not for the reason that the Arizona Supreme Court addressed in differentiating the two cases. As it noted in the Lucaszek case, there was no direct evidence tying that defendant to the conspiracy at all. So Merrill's testimony under those circumstances became very important. Here, in contrast, I mean, first and the most important and key to the case here, as the state court identified, was Mrs. Redmond's eyewitness testimony, identifying Hooper as one of the three men who committed the murders. As the court referenced, on top of that, there were also multiple other witnesses who testified to Hooper's involvement with.
So it's the other evidence. It's the other evidence, including, as we discussed previously, Mrs. Redmond, that make Hooper's case different in that respect.
That's right. And then as far as the finding that this impeachment was cumulative, that was a reasonable conclusion because, as was discussed with Mr. Phelan, the jury was well aware that Merrill received substantial benefit for his testimony. As the court had noted, in immunity and the death penalty coming off the table, I can't think of a greater benefit to a witness and more information that's more important to a jury's determination of a witness's credibility than knowing that this witness was potentially facing the death penalty. And because they decided to cooperate with the state and provide testimony in the case at issue, that's no longer on the table.
What about this idea, though, that there's something quantitatively different about money, that it just seems to be more corrupt because the prosecution, they have prosecutorial discretion. I mean, Merrill had a different role to play here. So even though the death penalty was technically on the table, maybe it never really was on the table. There's this prosecutorial discretion, which is fair to put on the table. But when you're talking about just payments of money, it's just different quantitatively, and we just need to treat it in a separate category. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree that, depending on the circumstances, financial payments to a witness may have some kind of different influence the jury's kind of decision-making in a different way, I guess it would be one way to say it. But ultimately, this is an EBBA case, and the reasonableness of the application of the standard that's at issue here. the Supreme Court has never held that failure to disclose a financial benefit is always material or is always prejudicial in a Brady claim. If that were the case, the issue here would be much different. That's not the case. I think, you know, financial benefits is always going to be reviewed, especially in the AEDPA context, in the context of the entire record, which is what the Arizona Supreme Court did here. And I think under all of the circumstances.
Let's take the Ludwig case and say that the same thing had happened where there wasn't a disclosure of the financial benefit until afterwards and say he had been convicted. Would the state's position be different in that case, that it would have been more prejudicial in the Ludwig facts because you wouldn't have had this other direct evidence? And so therefore Merrill would have been more important, and therefore it would have been more material that this evidence was left out? Or would you still be saying, hey, we all knew that Merrill was getting all these other benefits, so it doesn't, therefore it's just a cumulative benefit that he was receiving?
I think regardless, it remains the situation that it still is ultimately a cumulative benefit. And that's just because of the facts and circumstances of this case and the impeachment evidence that was in front of the jury here.
Well, no, but I'm saying in the Ludwig case, presumably you have the same impeachment evidence, but you just don't have, Mrs. Redmond, you don't have Campanoli, you don't have Louie. You don't have some of this other evidence coming in that was rather, you know, more overwhelming in the Hooper case. Would the state's position be different?
Okay, I'm sorry, I understand the question now. No, I don't think it would change our position on the conclusion that it was cumulative impeachment. It would change our position, I would think, on the other piece of the court's finding that his testimony itself was not pivotal, therefore this isn't material.
So, I mean, ultimately everything boils down to the cumulative analysis, because, I mean, here Merrill has less importance, so that's a factor. But ultimately the state's position is it's cumulative regardless, and that's really where the court needs to focus.
Well, I think it's hard for me to separate those two pieces out, the cumulative nature and the non-pivotal nature of his testimony. I suppose you could look at it in that, you know, additional impeachment is not as important in context because his testimony wasn't as pivotal in this case. I'm not sure that that is the way the Arizona Supreme Court viewed it. It seemed to look at these as kind of two separate reasons for concluding that the information wasn't material. But I mean, ultimately, yeah, I guess I would agree that, you know, it does depend on all of the facts and circumstances of the case. And part of that, which is different from Lukaszek, is the existence of other evidence of guilt. And as far as the photographs and the booking records, There's nothing in the record, and Mr. Valen said we'd have to speculate on how the defense could have used it. Well, speculation isn't enough to establish a Brady violation. So I think right there is enough reason to find that the Arizona Supreme Court reasonably concluded that because this information was at least available to the defense at the time of the trial, there's no Brady violation. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, I would rest on our brief for any of the remaining issues.
It doesn't appear that we do. Thank you very much, counsel, for your argument today. Let's put 3 minutes on the clock for Mr. Phelan to do a rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. As to Bagley being clearly established federal law, I refer the court to Holland versus Florida, 560 U.S. 631. A state case becomes final on the denial of cert if no cert is filed 90 days thereafter. Therefore, Bagley is clearly established federal law for purposes of this case. I want the court, please, to examine the nature of the hearing that took place in front of Judge Patterson when the information of payments came out. That hearing was characterized by repeated lies from Ryan and Merrill, minimization from Ryan and Merrill, and they were only brought to heel on their denials of the quantity and timing of the payments by documents that were presented to them and they were confronted with. Our point is, had the jury seen this kind of effort made by the state to not only suppress it to begin with, but then when caught, dissimulate, minimize, and deny, and effectively commit perjury and caught out by documents. This was a close case. The jury was out for 3 days. Judge Woods testified at the hearing at which this information was dragged out of the witnesses, to the fact that one of the jurors had told him, "I won't vote guilty in this case no matter how long I stay here." This was a close case, a little bit of evidence of the most tawdry kind, denied by the payor and payee, I think would have made a substantial difference. The problem with the district court's disposition of the prior's claim is that its insistence that what took place in the PCR court amounted to reweighing simply cannot be found in the text, the brief text of the PCR court's order. Respondents to this day insist that what happened was a reweighing. And they do that because if it's viewed as a harmless error analysis, it really fails, because what it looks like is an automatic affirmance which has been rejected by Clemens and Johnson. The question of whether, on ineffective assistance of counsel, I refer the court to the Correll versus Ryan case, which discusses trial counsel who did no mitigation investigation, disparaged it by calling it Mickey Mouse, so much smoke, just like Woods did. And I want to emphasize that Woods' strategy of trying to talk the judge out of imposing death is, as Judge Bennett said, not provided for in the Arizona statute. That is not a reasonable and statutorily provided means of obtaining a life sentence. There is one way to obtain a life sentence in Arizona. If the mitigation that has been mustered and presented to the jury or judge is sufficiently substantial to outweigh the aggravation, that's the only way. So his strategy was wrong as a matter of law, because he'd never done a capital sentencing in his life. He didn't know how the statute worked.
All right, you're over time, counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate your argument very much. Both sides, actually. We'll conclude it here. And I'll order the case submitted for a decision to be issued by this court in due course. Thank you very much for participating today.